This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is May 18th, 1999, and I'm in the Provost's office, John Wiley, and we're going to discuss today the Provost's years as graduate school dean. Let's go back a little bit before you applied for the deanship, and you were in the College of Engineering. What was your the nature and the extent of your relationship with the graduate school and with Dean Bach during those earlier years?
Well, I didn't have a whole lot of frequent contact with Dean Bach. Obviously, I had plenty of contact with the graduate mm-hmm. school because, in addition to being Associate Dean for Research and Engineering, which involves a lot of research and graduate student activities, mm-hmm. and all of that involves the graduate school, I had previously chaired a graduate-only program, the material science program. And so in that capacity, I came into pretty frequent contact with people in the graduate school, usually involving matters of student admissions, fellowships, advanced opportunity fellowships for minority students. What else? One incident that I remember quite clearly was kind of amusing. One year, Max Legale and I decided that we would brag a little bit in our literature for recruiting new graduate students. And so we told them, among other things, that the material science program at UW-Madison was listed, and I don't remember the exact number, but it was very high, third in the nation or something like that, in the Gorman Report, which is a widely sold, widely cited program rating service. And so we put that in our letters, and somehow or other, Dean Bach got a hold of one of those letters. And he called me up and really chewed me out. He said, even if you're ranked number one in the Gorman Report, you should never mention them. That's such a shabby, disgraceful report that it just gives them added credibility when you cite them. So you should never cite them under any circumstances. And I subsequently spent some time looking into that issue, and I absolutely agree with him now. Jack Gorman does this as a private money-making enterprise. He and his wife apparently put these rankings together and sell their book every year to bookstores and libraries around the country. People buy them. And as far as anyone can tell, there's absolutely nothing credible behind the ratings. As a matter of fact, on the contrary, programs leap around in those rankings. They go from nearly last to nearly first from one year to the next, and no program can change that much in one year. Mm-hmm. So he's never released his methodology. He says it's proprietary. So he may just be sitting in a dark room somewhere making this stuff up or throwing darts.
Throwing darts, yeah.
But he certainly makes a lot of money on the book.
Oh, my.
And that was my first introduction to program rankings, and that's a subject that's kind of interested me ever since.
Not bad.
But Bach was dead right about that.
What else were you learning about the graduate school and your associations with them in your years at the CLU?
Well, it's, I can only remember general impressions,
okay.
Not a whole lot of detail. A few details I remember, but there was a general feeling across the campus at that time, and I'm talking about the 80s,
mm-hmm.
that the graduate school was extraordinarily bureaucratic and rule-bound, that everything was done mechanically, and that exceptions were not made even under exceptional circumstances, that everything was just, all decisions were made in effect by a computer. If there was a rule, the rule was enforced rigidly, even when it didn't fit very well. So there's a lot of dissatisfaction with things of that sort. I'll give you a couple of examples. We, like most universities, send all of our PhD theses to University Microfilms in Ann Arbor, Michigan, for archiving.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I mean, we archive a hardbound copy in our library, but for purposes of distribution and sales and so on, Ann Arbor handles it for the whole country, University Microfilms. And they have certain rules on the format of the thesis. The margins have to be at least 1.5 inches on one side of the page and 1 inch on the other side, and top and bottom, and font size, and how you should handle subscripts and superscripts and underlinings and so on. Quite a few production rules associated with it. Now, with that in mind, jump to the way theses get produced. students work for 4 or 5 or more years on a project. They write it up. Usually we're talking about a document of 2 to many hundreds of pages long. Nowadays it's relatively easy to make changes with word processors, but in the 80s that was not so common. A lot of theses were typed. Some typed on stencil masters, mm-hmm. Mimeograph masters, so that the typewriter didn't use a ribbonet. The keys actually cut through wax to make the letters. These are things that are not easy to change. And the student turns in a draft copy of the thesis, goes to an oral exam. The committee possibly makes editorial suggestions or changes, so there's some last-minute revisions. By this time, the student often as not has a job and mm-hmm. has made plans to move, leave Madison. And so they make the changes as best they can and bring the thesis into the graduate school for a final checkout, which involves going to a particular office in the grad school, presenting the final master copy of the thesis, and having it checked for conformity with mm-hmm. all these rules. The woman who, the people who did that job, there was always one person who did it. But I started to say the woman who did it, but it was many, many different women. It was always a female. And it was a burnout job. They changed every few months because people just could not do this for any length of time. The reason being that the rules were enforced to the tiniest detail. They kept very finely divided rulers in that room and measured every single margin on every page. And if there was one page somewhere that was a millimeter off, they were sent back to redo it. Now imagine how that sits with a student who's flown back from California mm-hmm. to be here 2 days to get their thesis checked, turn it into the library, pay their final fees, and leave, thinking that they're done. All of a sudden they're told they've got to go back and do revisions. In some cases, dozens of pages scattered throughout the thing that missed having the right margin by a fraction of a millimeter or something. So we had a lot of very unhappy students, threatened lawsuits, screaming and yelling, protests, appeals. It was just nonstop. And so one of the first things, just jumping ahead a little bit, mm-hmm. one of the very first things I did when I came to the grad school was outlaw rulers in that room. I told the woman who was doing that job at the time that if she couldn't tell by looking, just by looking without measuring, mm-hmm. Then it was acceptable. And that was a revolution in that part of the operation. The same person has now done that job for the last at least 10 years.
Well, from my own perspective, I was a graduate student here, and the person up with the ruler was referred to as the Dragon Lady, and I could remember being almost as nervous going there as I was going to my orals, and these horror stories about people who had complicated charts and graphs typed by foreign students who went back to Africa or Asia and weren't even available for retyping, and it was...
It just was a mess.
Quite a
now,
mess.
You could go interview Cleo Sorensen. This is her last semester here. She's retiring. She's held that job for about 10 years. I don't remember exactly how long. But she regularly gets boxes of candy and flowers from the students who bring their thesis in for a checkout. She gives them good advice ahead of time and a very respectful final checkout. And she forgives small transgressions of the rules, mm-hmm. which is as it should be.
As it should be, indeed. when did you first hear that Dean Bach was resigning from the graduate school? Do you remember how that...
No, I really don't. I think... Is this one going to be embargoed?
Yes, absolutely, if you care to.
Well, I had the impression that Dean Bach did not... either didn't respect or didn't like or didn't get along well with Chancellor Shalala. Mm-hmm. I don't know that to mm-hmm. be the case, but that was my impression. It wouldn't surprise me, just knowing their personalities. So she may have pressured him, but I don't know that. She never told me. I do know this about her. From the day she stepped on campus, she decided that she would be a chief executive and that she would not deal with day-to-day details of anything, that she would do fundraising and university relations, concentrate on the legislature, the governor, the system administration, and delegate the internal operations of the university to her subordinates. And the one thing that she told them whenever she was getting complaints about something was make it go away. And what she told me when I was appointed dean of the graduate school was, I don't want to hear any more complaints about all these rigid rules and all of this petty bureaucracy. I want you to modernize the graduate school. I don't want to hear anything more about it. And she did that also with information technology and a number of other areas, undergraduate education, teaching assistants, advising. Anything that she was getting complaints on, she would find the person she was going to put in charge of it and then say, make it stop. I don't want to hear any more about it.
Now, let's get back. Go back just 1 second. You said she came in and behaved more like a CEO than than the traditional chancellor role from before. Was this something that she decided herself, or do you think the regents were in favor of that? Do you have any idea?
Oh, I think she decided it. I don't think the regents probably had much of an opinion on it. I don't know for sure. But getting back to answering your question directly, I can't remember when I found out that Bach was stepping down, but it was very shortly after she arrived. And he was he had served for I think 22 years as dean of the graduate school, and it was he was getting on an age, and he didn't retire right away. He became the director of UIR for a while, but I think there was a general view on campus that it was time for him to step down, that he had been dean too long.
22 years is a long time to hold one position, a long time. How did you get dragged into this? I think you mentioned last time that other people submitted your name?
Yeah, I didn't apply for it, as far as I can recall. In fact, I'm quite sure I didn't. But I was told that I had been nominated by several people. And I remember getting a letter from the committee asking permission to leave my name on the list, and I discussed it with Jim Taylor, I think maybe only with Jim Taylor, maybe also John Bollinger, but I can't really remember for sure. And I decided to do it because Jim said it would be a good chance to sound off and say what I thought was wrong with the graduate school and what needed to be improved and so on. So I did, without any intention. First of all, I had never known any other dean but a biologist, and there's so much biological science on this campus that it was inconceivable to me that the next dean of the graduate school would not be a biologist, or, barring that, that it would not be someone from LNS, being the largest college on campus. The thought of picking an engineering professor as dean of the graduate school just it seemed a little outlandish to me. And actually, I mentioned that to Donna toward the end, and she said, because I had an LNS degree, it made me span two colleges, and that tipped it for her, something like that.
Did you hear anything beforehand about whether they were thinking of going internal or external or anything along those lines?
No, but I think the graduate school at Madison is a special place, and it's very unlikely that an outsider would ever be selected to run it. It's not impossible. We've had outside candidates in the past, but I think it's, of all of our positions, that one is the one most likely to always be an insider.
Now, you went to the interview, the committee was there. Do you remember anything about who was on that committee that interviewed anybody?
Well, let's see, I remember the chair of it was a professor of plant pathology who's now retired and gone to North Carolina. And I should know his name immediately. He's a very eminent scientist. I'll think of it in just a minute. The kids tell me I have Halfheimer's when I can't remember something. I don't remember any of the other members of the committee, though.
Okay. Did you do what you said? How did you do what you set out to do?
Yeah. I remember being very relaxed going into the interview. It was kind of a lark. I did not believe that I would be competitive for the position. I didn't have any interest in the job, and I just thought there was nothing at stake. So I just used it as a chance to tell them what I thought about the grad school.
What did you say?
Oh, I complained about the rigidity, the rule-bound behavior, and the need to sort of modernize the style of doing things. Mm-hmm.
Well, how did they respond?
I don't really remember, except there was one student member who seemed to be pretty, and I don't remember who it was, or whether it was a graduate or an undergraduate student, probably a graduate student. But he asked me what the committee, he asked me why I wanted the job, and I said, I don't. I remember that pretty clearly. And he looked a little surprised at that. And then he said, well, what could we do to convince you to be interested in it? I said, nothing. You couldn't. I'm really not that interested in it. I left my name on the list a little bit reluctantly, hoping to have a chance to just tell you what I thought of the graduate school. I've done that. I'm happy where I am. And that was pretty much the end of the interview. I mean, it was that came toward the end.
What did you think afterwards?
I thought I did what I came to do, and now I'll go back and do my job.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I was involved at that time in quite a number of things in engineering that I thought were interesting and enjoyable.
Now, I think I recall you saying last time that you did not know who the other candidates were for the job.
No, I to this day, I don't believe. I may have known at one time some of them, but if I did, I've forgotten. I really don't know who else were candidates.
Now, a few days or a few weeks or maybe a month passes and you get a phone call, I suspect, saying that you were selected by the committee. Talk about that whole process.
Well, I got a phone call from Chancellor Shalala.
Uh-huh.
And she wanted to talk to me. So I came over and talked to her, and I don't really recall if she offered me the job at that time or not, but we talked about it. And I do remember, she must have let it be known that I was a finalist or being seriously considered or something. She may have interviewed all the shortlist people, I don't know. But I do know that she also asked me to go see David Ward. She had just appointed him provost.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went over to geography in Science Hall and met with him in his office for a little while. And then she later had me back in again, maybe a few days later. This is all very vague in my memory now. And offered it to me. And I gave her all of the reasons why I really wasn't that interested in doing it. And over the course of half an hour, an hour of talking, she convinced me to do it.
Was this your first association with the chancellor?
Yeah, in any detail. Yeah. I had met her at receptions and things like that, but that was the first time I'd ever talked to her one-on-one.
And what about the current chancellor, David Ward? Was that your first meeting with him when you went over to the geography?
Yeah, same. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In fact, I didn't really know him before that. I knew who he was, but I didn't.
I would assume that, maybe I'm assuming wrong, that part of your reason to accept the job might have been because of the people you would be working with in the administration, Chancellor's Ward and Chancellor Ward.
Well, I do remember that there were two or three things that she said that sort of resonated with me.
Okay.
One was that she was building a new team, that Irv Shane had been chancellor for quite a while, and Bach had been in the graduate school for a long time, and Dave Cronin had been LNS dean for a long time. There was a general feeling, certainly her personal impression looking at the campus, and the feeling that she got from talking to people around campus, that the whole place had become a little sleepy or stagnated a bit by too many people being in their jobs for too long.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they weren't doing a good job, but that they were just doing it the same way, and everyone gets in a rut, or everyone develops their prejudices or their biases about how to do things. So she painted this picture of a really exciting time of change, of renewal of the campus, and new ways of doing things, new looks at old habits, that sort of thing. And it sort of resonated with me. And secondly, she said that while it might be a lot of fun to do the things I was doing, like my own research or teaching courses or running some programs within the College of Engineering, that this was an opportunity to extend my reach, that the same hour of effort put in on my own work versus put in on facilitating other people's work could have a bigger effect, bigger impact, and that there comes a time when you have to put your personal ego and personal ambitions aside, and devote yourself to the institution at large. And that also resonated mm-hmm. with me. She expressed it much better than I just did. She's a very good salesperson.
Yeah.
But that was the essence of what she told me. And
is that what pushed you over?
Yeah. Yeah. She said you can have a much bigger impact from Bascom Hall than you ever could within any one college.
Okay.
And do things that affect the entire institution and its future direction, and you know, blah blah blah.
Besides the wanting the complaints to stop, did she give you any other advice or any other instructions about what she was expecting of you?
Yeah, she had pretty much the same attitude toward everything. If you're going to do it, whatever it is, you should strive to be among the very best of class in whatever it is you're doing. I remember she had no particular interest in athletics herself, mm-hmm. personally.
Oh, really?
She said, if we're going to have a football program, it should be as good as our academic programs.
Interesting.
And so I'm going to go out and get a really terrific coach, and we're going to be competitive. We're not going to just do it with our left hand, so to speak. And she had the same attitude toward everything. Whatever we're going to do, we're going to be among the best at. And she pushed that theme relentlessly.
When you accepted and you moved into the deanship, or maybe even before you moved into the deanship, had you set any personal goals for yourself as graduate school dean, based on what you knew about the graduate school, what the chancellor was after, and any plans that you had?
Well, I think more than anything else, I just wanted to kind of humanize it. Mm-hmm. That's vague, I know. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to see what could be done to bring human judgment into the decision-making mm-hmm. process, and reduce the reliance on mechanical rules for everything.
Mm-hmm. Who were, when you came into your office the first day, who were the staff, who greeted you? Who were the staff, key staff members at the graduate school at the time?
The key staff members, without a doubt, were Marita Weiss and Marv Ebel. They were both longtime associate deans, and Eric Grudy. They knew the operations of the graduate school really well. And I remember being very nervous about the large number of things that needed to get done and the huge stakes involved. There are all kinds of reports that have to be filed mm-hmm. with the federal government by certain dates, and notifications that have to go out to the campus by certain other dates, and so on. And I did not have a good overview of that, so I bugged the staff for the first couple of weeks to prepare year-long calendars of deadlines and timelines of when things have to be done and so on, as much for my own purpose, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. just for learning, as for any actions. But apparently I irritated a lot of people by mm-hmm. doing that. They knew their jobs, even if I didn't know their mm-hmm. jobs. And having to sit down and write it all out for me seemed unnecessary or burdensome. So mm-hmm. anyway, I remember very clearly a few weeks after moving in up there, Marv Ebel and Marita Weiss came in and closed the door. Mm-hmm. And they said, John, you've got to relax a little bit. Everything's under control here. We know what needs doing. And whenever you have to do something, we'll tell you.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. And I realized that they were right, that they had a lot at stake too, mm-hmm. and that they knew their jobs well. They'd been doing them for a long time. They weren't going to let something important slip through mm-hmm. the cracks. Mm-hmm. And that I could just relax and learn things on a more casual mm-hmm. time scale. And periodically ask questions about why are we doing this mm-hmm. or why are we doing that and so on. But I stopped worrying about dropping the ball on some big issue, and nothing like that ever mm-hmm. happened.
Let's talk about those three members, staff members, for a while. What was Marv Ebel's responsibility, what were his responsibilities?
The graduate school is organized by division, has been for as long as I can remember, meaning that there's one half-time faculty associate dean for each division. Mm-hmm. Marv was the associate dean for the physical sciences division, and he had been in that role for quite a long time. So he was the senior associate dean of the academic associate deans. Merida was is the associate dean for administration, budget, and personnel, that sort of thing. And she had been in that role for a long time, too. So they were the two most experienced associate deans. Eric Grudy, I can't remember exactly what his title was. I believe it was assistant dean.
I think he was an associate dean at that point. Quite sure, yeah.
But he also had been there for quite a while, and he knew a lot of the research funding operations in the graduate school. He worked pretty closely with Merida.
Did those people, to the best of your knowledge, share your concerns about the graduate school, about some of the rule-bound, tradition-bound?
Not immediately. I think it's like any organization, if you've been used to doing things a certain way, you worry a lot about the unforeseen consequences of change. Marv, in particular, was very conservative that way. And so I could always count on him, and this is not a criticism of him. Mm. On the contrary, this is valuable. I could count on Marv to give me the 10 best reasons for not making almost any change that I proposed making. And they would be really good reasons.
That's an important person.
So, yeah, you bet it is. And so anytime I wanted to change something, I would first discuss it with Marv, sometimes also with Merida, and listen to all the reasons why I shouldn't do it. And if I could either address or dismiss all of his concerns, I felt pretty comfortable going forward.
That's nice. Well, you have to have that kind of skeptical person in there to broaden one's own vision.
He also had a very good memory, history of what had been tried before and how it had worked or not worked and why and so on.
Do you remember how long he'd been in the graduate school before you?
No, I don't.
I could certainly find that out. Let's just locate the graduate school very briefly. Where was it located when you took over in July of 1989, I believe it was?
You mean physically?
Physically, yeah. Physically.
Right where it is today. Second and third floors of Bascom Hall in the north wing. Yeah.
Did the fact that it was on two different floors cause any problems? Oh, we'll get into that in a little bit. Yeah, let's just getting ahead of myself.
Yes. Yes, it did.
Let's talk about something that we talked about a little bit last time, and I want to straighten out in my own mind, and that's your management style. When I talked to the several people I talked to prior to this interview, I heard total quality management mentioned several times. I heard Joanne Nagy say, is what you did actually total quality management? I remember from the last interview you talked about Dean Bollinger introducing you to strategic planning. Could you kind of unravel that and explain where you come from?
Yeah, first, I guess if you have any feeling, if anyone's giving you the impression that somehow or other I'm a model manager, I would like to dispel that. I've heard Donna say to other people, and Donna tends to state as fact what she wishes were fact. Let's put it that way. She says expresses things the way she would like them to be. I've heard her say to people that she picked me for the graduate school because the graduate school needed a genuine manager. And so this is the first time the graduate school had had someone with real management experience. Well, that's just silly. If she was referring to my qualifications or something, it may have needed that, but that was not evident in my background. In fact, to this day, it isn't. I never had any management training. I don't like some aspects of management, probably the same ones that most people don't like. So I would say that my strengths are probably closer to the leadership side of the job than the management side of the job. Our change agent is more where my strengths lie, because I'm pretty persistent. If I get an idea of doing something differently, I can be pretty persistent in pushing it. And although I will give up if it looks like it's not working, I get harder and harder to convince as you go along. So, Let's see, I lost track of your question.
The question was the total quality management versus strategic planning.
Well, the first introduction I had to anything that was even remotely management-oriented was when I was Bollinger's associate dean for research, and he was on a lot of
Your first introduction was with Dean Bollinger.
Yeah, he was on a lot of corporate boards and was quite impressed with the way industries, companies are managed as opposed to universities. And more so than most people around here, I guess, he really wanted to introduce a sort of corporate model in the management of the College of Engineering. Most of us thought that was not a good thing to do. Most of us thought that corporate ways of doing things were not compatible with universities. But there were some aspects of what he did and what he wanted to do that, in retrospect, made a lot of sense. And one of them that has really stuck with me was this concept of strategic planning. I'm pretty sure that he's the first person I ever heard actually use that term. And in those days, I never read any of the business or management literature, like Harvard Business Review or books on how to manage things and so on. So I had never seen any of those terms before or paid much attention to them. John was quite persistent in insisting that the departments and the college as a whole in engineering engage in serious strategic planning. And he actually had an outline for how that would be done. There was a pretty formal process that we went through, and he eventually got us to do it. And I think most people in the college eventually came to believe that it was a good idea, and it really worked. So I did bring that with me to the graduate school, and if that's what Donna was referring to, it's better than nothing, but it isn't much.
So TQM was not really something that you were directly involved with?
Well, yes and no. After, or at about the time that I went to the graduate school, I got interested. I'd heard the terms several times, heard about total quality management and quality programs, and I was curious about it. So I remember going on an airplane trip and buying a book by Mary Walton called The Deming Management Method, or something like that. Buying it at an airport bookstore. Took it with me on the plane to read, and I remember exactly what happened. I read about the first 10 or 15 pages and thought, this is nonsense. You know, nothing in here is going to be relevant to me. So I closed it and stuck it in the pocket on the back of the seat in front of me, and read the airplane magazine instead. I finished that. I wasn't sleepy. I had nothing else to do, so I got the Mary Walton book out again and picked up where I left off and actually ended up finishing it. By the time I finished the book, I was intrigued enough that I reread the whole thing on the flight back.
What intrigued you?
The logic of it. If you strip it of all the, if you strip this TQM of all the jargon and acronyms and everything, it's nothing more than common sense. It's data-based, fact-based decision-making and thoughtful planning. That's all it is. And now the people who make a living as consultants going out and teaching people how to do this disagree vehemently with what I just said. They say it's way more than that, and if that's all you think it is, you've misunderstood it.
Okay.
But I think they're wrong. I think they have a vested interest in making it seem more arcane and obscure than it is. That's how they make their living.
That's how they make, of course.
And so, at its core, I think all it is just good common sense, decent human relations, acknowledging that the people who are doing a particular job know more about that job than the people who are managing them, and so pushing decisions down to the lowest level where they can be reasonably made is generally a good thing to do, and so on. It's all just common sense.
Mike Williamson and Maury Connor, their names were mentioned to me by a couple of people. What was their role in all this?
Well, I don't remember when Donna brought Mike on, but he had been involved in the City of Madison's and some state agencies' TQM efforts, and knew a fair bit about it from the formal structural viewpoint. He may have, if he came on Donna's team before I did, he may have urged her to appoint me in the graduate school, but I don't know that I don't know that he was there yet. I do know that he he was sort of an advocate for me in a number of issues in the subsequent years, primarily because he thought I was one of his co-conspirators in planting the concepts of TQM on this campus. And Maury is someone that we hired in the graduate school initially, I believe. I don't remember. You'll have to ask her mm-hmm. exactly how she came on.
Oh, she's still.
Yes, she's here. She's here now. I mean, right as we speak, she's on leave of absence, consulting for Berkeley, teaching them how to do it. But she'll be back in a couple weeks. I think we hired Maury first in the graduate school, but I'm not mm-hmm. sure about that. Mike Williamson may have hired her in the chancellor's office.
What about the chancellor and the provost, Shalala and Ward? Did they get involved in this as well, in the total quality management?
Not as much, although they both acknowledged that it was a good direction to be going mm-hmm. and that we should be doing it. Mm-hmm. And they bragged about the successes that it was having in various places around campus where it was being implemented.
I was suggested that I ask you about the Arboretum retreat that was held shortly after you became dean, in the relation to
the grad school retreat.
The grad school retreat, yeah. Right.
Well, we did have a facilitated retreat to begin doing making some plans for the graduate school, and although I don't know that they continued to this day, we did develop an overall strategic plan mm-hmm. for the graduate school. We had point people responsible for various aspects of improvement. We had specific projects that mm-hmm. we launched, and it may have been at the Arboretum retreat. See, we did these retreats every year and had other planning meetings mm-hmm. in between. It may have been at the Arboretum retreat where we launched our first two big projects, and we consciously chose one project that we thought would have a big campus-wide impact, mm-hmm. but that was very difficult and challenging, and we may or may not be able to do it. And another project that would be just internal to the graduate school, but that would be quick and easy and certain to succeed. That was our feeling.
What were they?
The big campus-wide project was improving the admissions process uh-huh. for graduate students, and the internal project was improving the delivery of mail within the graduate school.
The delivery of mail?
Yes.
Talk about
the graduate school offices up here in mm-hmm. in Bascom get about, at that time they got about 500,000 pieces of mail a year. And sorting that all and getting it to the right person is a big undertaking.
Yeah.
Now, a good share of that is associated with grad student admissions. And so during the admission season, the mail arrives in big gray U.S. mail sacks on carts, five or six bags at a time. That's the busiest part of the year. But throughout the year, it averages several thousand pieces of mail a day, sometimes of the year. So getting it all sorted and distributed correctly and making sure that nothing important gets lost and so on is a big undertaking. There was a lot of dissatisfaction about the delivery of mail. Everyone had horror stories about getting the wrong mail, getting something that was intended to go to someone else, getting it 3 weeks late, date stamped 3 weeks ago and it's just now hitting my mm-hmm. desk for the first time today, things of that sort. So we decided that ought to be easy to fix. We spent, I think, 3 months logging every single piece of mail. Every person in the graduate school had to keep a log of every piece of mail they received and jot down some things about it, like the time delay between the timestamp when it was received in the mail room and the time that they got it, whether or not they should have been the one to get it, and so on. We found the error rate was almost nil. All of this unread, unease over getting the wrong mail mm-hmm. was because people had long memories. And if, mm-hmm. if something ever happened mm-hmm. wrong, they remembered it forever and claimed that it always happened. In fact, the error rate was just trivially small. Mm. But it also showed us how much of the mail was really useful and how much was junk. So we had a big category of junk mail that was interfering with things. And we took steps to reduce that, to get rid of the unsolicited catalogs and books and other things that were being sent up there for no good reason, that just clogged the in-baskets.
Ah, that's amazing.
And we also found out that although there wasn't much mail getting misdirected, we relied very heavily on the personal knowledge of a few people to know who does what in the graduate school. So the real beneficial outcome of that project was not improving the mail process, which was pretty good already, contrary to our belief. Mm-hmm. It was developing a very good and dynamic, you know, changeable, computerized directory of who does what, who is responsible for what. And the guy who was the receptionist in the graduate school actually put that all that information into a database and greatly improved our ability to handle phone calls. A lot of phone calls come in as well as mail. And they come primarily to the receptionist if they don't know who else to call. And that person needs to know who to direct the call to. And it turns out that he was sending the call to this person and they would say, no, it really should go to that person. No, it should really go to this person. It bounced around sometimes three or four times and people would just get disgusted and hang up. They're getting a runaround. So he developed this computerized database that enabled him to type keywords as he listened when they're asking their question. And by the time they finished their question, he had the right person's name on his screen and could direct the call to the right person the very first time. That was a big improvement.
Yeah.
So it turns out that what we thought was an obvious, easy, simple little project that was a dead cinch to fix ended up in a lot of improvements, none of them having to do with the mail per se. It was not a problem. And one of the things I learned from that was that you seldom really know what the problem is when you start. If all you have is anecdote and impressions, when you really look at the data, look at the details, it may look very different.
Were your colleagues in the graduate school surprised at what you were finding?
Absolutely. Everyone agreed. I think everyone you talk to will agree with what I just said. We were all stunned by that. And that project also resulted in a few other improvements, having to do with reducing the stresses on certain key people in the mail distribution process and so on. The admissions one turned out to be actually easier than we expected it to be and resulted in a dramatically bigger improvement.
I had that set for a little later in the interview, but let's talk about it since it's come up in context. Describe the admissions policy that was in operation when you came in.
Well, admissions here is decentralized in one sense and centralized in another. Graduate admission is done by each graduate degree program, and there are over 100 of those, 110 or so. So, but on the other hand, the graduate school does have the authority to block the admission of a student who is deemed not qualified. Graduate school can't admit students and force them on programs, but they can prevent programs from taking in students who shouldn't be in graduate school here. Do you see what I mean? So, when students apply here, they apply simultaneously to the department and the graduate school. The departments make their decisions and tell the graduate school who they want to admit, and the graduate school approves those unless they object. If they object to one, they deny admission. When I went up there, one of the big complaints campus-wide was the length of time that it takes the graduate school to make its decisions. Departments had made their decisions, they wanted to make offers to students. The students were getting offers from other schools, and the allegation was that the graduate school was holding things up by taking so long. So we decided that we would streamline the grad school's processes to be responsive to that complaint. And it turned out we started by just gathering the facts, and we did a lot of data gathering. And there was a distribution of times for decisions, but I think the average was about 90 days. At the two extremes, some decisions were made within a few weeks, others were two or more years.
Oh my gosh.
Imagine that.
Oh.
Now those were, I should hasten to add that those were all exceptional cases where even the student was involved in mm-hmm. causing the delay by withdrawing an application and then resubmitting it and withdrawing it again and resubmitting it and so on. But nevertheless, on the books, pending a final decision, there were cases that had been around for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Yeah. So once we knew how long
was 90 days considered long?
Oh, yes.
Wouldn't you lose students?
You bet.
Things?
We were probably losing all kinds of students. And you lose the best ones because they're the ones who have multiple offers and other opportunities. So after we knew what the facts were, we started asking, okay, where does this delay occur? Why does it take so long? And we analyzed the entire process. We flowcharted it. I won't go into that. Maybe Joanne or someone still has the big papers that we used to draw the diagrams, but they were enormous.
Mm-hmm.
If you unroll them in a scroll fashion, they'd be probably 20 or 30 feet long.
Joanne Nagy you're talking
yeah.
about. And she was very instrumental in this.
She was very important in this. She was an assistant dean at the time. It turns out that there were a lot of places where there were delays that we could tinker with, but we quickly found out that there was one really big one, and that was, let me back up a second. One of the things we decided to do was benchmark with other schools, and so we picked a bunch of schools that, according to our general impression, were doing it well, that were able to admit students a lot faster than we did. And we divided those schools up, and each had to call a few of them.
Hmm.
And one of the schools that I called was Berkeley. And I talked to the grad dean there and asked how long it took them to make a decision on admission, and he said, without any hesitation, 5 days. So I took that information back to our group and said, 5 days is now our goal. If Berkeley can do it, we can do it. They get as many applications as we do. They're organized pretty much the same way we are, and there's no reason why we can't do it as fast as they do. So we're going to do whatever we have to do to make our decisions in 5 days or less. And ultimately, we got it down to 3 from 90. But the biggest improvement, I think, and Joanne would have to verify this, but I'm pretty sure that the biggest improvement in terms of shortening the time was eliminating the calculation of a composite undergraduate grade point average. Mm-hmm. At that time, every applicant had to submit all of the transcripts from all undergraduate work they had ever done anywhere. Now remember, we got 15 to 20,000 applications. Many students have been to 3 or 4 different undergraduate schools. I seem to remember that every application generates about 25 or 30 pieces of paper, including all of the various transcripts and things and letters of reference and so on. But we had experts who would sit down and take all those transcripts and recompute a composite GPA, an overall GPA, for all undergraduate work ever done anywhere, converting from 3-point to 4-point grade scales and that kind of stuff in the process. And it was a very time-consuming job, as you can imagine,
mm-hmm.
And that was a cause of a significant fraction of the delay. So, in a meeting up in what's now Joanne's office, I remember asking, why do we do this? Why do we? It seems like a meaningless number anyway.
Mm-hmm.
A GPA for one school is already a pretty blunt instrument for summarizing a student's record. If you've got the transcript in front of you, you can see the individual grades and individual courses and probably get a better feeling for their academic mm-hmm. preparation than just from looking at a number, 3.62. So why would we want to compute an overall GPA for all undergraduate work? And no one in the room knew, except one person. The secretary, the grad secretary for the Department of Sociology, whose name slips my mind right now. Mm-hmm. But she knew. She said, I know why the department, excuse me. Nobody knew the reason, except someone speculated it's because the departments want it.
Uh-huh.
The departments want to know that number. It helps them make their admission decisions. So I asked the secretary from sociology, who was on the team, why do the departments want it? She said, oh, I know why they want it. It's because we don't know in advance which students we're going to nominate for graduate fellowships. And the graduate fellowship application process asks for that number. We don't have the time or expertise to compute it in the departments, so we're glad that the graduate school computes it for us. So the next logical question is, well, why does the fellowship office mm-hmm. of the graduate school require mm-hmm. this number? So that we, as it happened, we had no one from the fellowship's office on our team. So I personally walked down the hall 20 feet to the fellowship's office and said, why do you require this composite GPA on the fellowship application form or nomination form? And they said, well, it's not a very helpful number, but it's already available on the application material, so why not use it? So it was a closed loop. Nobody really wanted it, but an awful lot of effort was going into computing it.
Oh my goodness.
So with one stroke on that day, we decided that we would no longer compute that number, that we would instead ask the students to self-report an undergraduate mm-hmm. GPA on the application form and warn them that if it seriously misrepresents their undergraduate record, we do have their transcripts after mm-hmm. all, and anyone who's misrepresented themselves on their application could be retroactively mm-hmm. kicked out of graduate mm-hmm. school. But for the first year after we used the self-reported GPA, we did spot checks and we never found a misrepresentation.
Oh my.
So all of that work was for nothing, all those years.
Oh. Those people with their...
Thousands and thousands of person hours of work. And that by itself dropped the time from 90 days to, I don't know, ask Joanne, 10 or 15, something
That's
like that.
That's astonishing.
And then the next improvements brought it on down to about 3.
Then you were just kind of tightening it up after
As a matter of fact, the average time for... by the time we were done with this process and had run our new process for a couple of years, the average time for admission was probably something like 15 or 20 days. But the graduate school's contribution to that time was 3 days. Now mm-hmm. the departments were contributing the biggest lag.
Did you work with the departments on that, or was that their own?
No, we worked with them on it. Mm-hmm. We told them the advantages of making quick decisions. There are some departments that don't really care, because in their field, there's a nationwide agreement that all departments will make their decisions on the same day. Mm-hmm. And so they all delay until that time, and then they all decide at once who to make offers mm-hmm. to. But that's not very common.
Yeah. Since we talked about these people calculating these GPAs, one of the things that I believe it was Joanne Nagy told me, she talked about the fact that the graduate school only had two computers when you became dean, and
right.
they were both Wangs, and they were stuck off in this room they called the Wang Room. Talk about how you turned that about, turn that around.
Sure. There were a few other computers.
And remember, let me set the stage. This is in 1989.
89, that's right.
Other places, even people like me, had been using computers for 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. Well, engineering was pretty well equipped.
Mm-hmm.
So I was used to having a computing environment, including a local area network, that was pretty effective. And office calendaring and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I was pretty stunned to find in the dean's office an IBM PC XT, which was already very outdated mm-hmm. in 1989. But not only that, it was dusty. It hadn't been touched for a long time. And so one of the first things that I decided we needed to do was get computers into the graduate school for all of our operations. And I think I'm proud to say that the graduate school today is probably the best computerized mm. place on campus, maybe rivaling the computer-aided engineering mm. center or the space science and engineering center or places like that. And the way I did it was pretty simple. This is an example of what I meant earlier by being more of a change agent than a manager per se. I hired Jane Fox and gave her a single sheet of paper with a diagram on it that said, this is the functionality I want. I want to be able to do the following things. I don't care how we accomplish it. And she designed the architecture of it and specified the equipment and went around and talked to everyone. We did make a decision that at that time there was quite a divided opinion among anyone you talk to on whether you should use IBM or Macintosh machines.
Right, I remember that debate.
And we made the decision that people could choose whichever one they felt most comfortable with, and that we would accommodate the differences instead of forcing everyone to have the same thing. That it was that the direction of technology was such that those differences would gradually disappear anyway, and this is borne out. Mm-hmm. This has been turned out to be true, and that whenever we needed to pass data between the machines or something, we would just live with the interface and the need to translate or whatever. Mm-hmm. And Jane agreed with that philosophy, and we did, as a matter of fact, have quite a variety of different machines. In fact, for quite a while, I had both. I had a Macintosh for doing graphics and a PC for interfacing with the other associate deans.
What about the graduate school staff? Have they been? Did you have to teach them to be computer literate, essentially? Or?
Oh yeah, and Jane took care of organizing and arranging the training. She did everything. She did the whole thing.
I can't. You said you got those sacks full of mail every day,
yeah.
And then you didn't have computers to.
Yeah, a lot of stuff was done by hand.
Oh,
the goodness. Fellowship allocation and application process was done by hand on charts that would not fit on this table that we're sitting at here. For your recorder, the table is about 3.5 feet wide and about 7 feet, eight feet long.
Yeah.
Those charts were at least twice as big as this table, and they were meticulously drawn with rulers and filled in with pencil and gigantic grids.
The people hours that went into that kind of stuff is unbelievable. Dean Reed noted that there was a cultural divide between the second and the third floors. Could you explain, do you understand what he was talking about first?
Yeah.
Could you explain what that divide was and how you eventually bridged the gap?
Well, I don't know whether this is fair or not, but it was attributed to Dean Bock that he had little, if any, interest in the student affairs side of the graduate school, focusing entirely on the research programs, and he just delegated the student-related stuff to other people and paid no attention to it. That's what I was told. I don't have any personal knowledge or evidence of that. But in any case, it is true that the dean's office and all of the associate deans were on the third floor of the graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And the accounting office was also on the third floor, where the budget decisions were made and so on. And the second floor was devoted entirely to admissions, fellowships, and student affairs. People from the second floor were reluctant to walk up to the third floor and bother someone, was the way they would have put it. And people from the third floor rarely, if ever, set foot on the second floor. So it was like two different units.
Oh my.
I think maybe Marita was about the only one who really, or Marita and Eric Grudy to some extent, and Carol Miller, who was an assistant dean.
Mm-hmm.
Have people talked about Carol Miller?
No, yet? I don't know. I've never heard her name before.
Well, it's good that you said that, because she was a he.
Oh, he. Okay. Carol.
He had the unusual male first name, Carol.
Huh.
Carol Miller was an assistant dean. Carol and Eric and Marita, I think, provided the glue and understood the culture on the second floor and went out of their way to try to make people on the second floor feel like they were doing important work and so on, but almost no one else did, as far as I can tell. And so that was something that we consciously worked at improving.
And so Dean Bock was just kind of remote and removed from that?
So I'm told, yeah. So I made it a point to, when I came to work, to enter through a door that would let me walk up to the second floor, walk through the second floor hallway, and then on up to the third floor, and stop and chat with people on the second floor on my way to the office as often as I could.
Were there any room assignments? Were room assignments changed, or was it just
There were room assignments changed, and we made sure that people from the second floor were put on all of the projects, all of the quality improvement projects teams that we launched. We changed some of the meetings to make sure that second and third floor were represented at all of the important decision-making meetings. Joanne, in particular, had just been hired as an assistant dean and was more or less in charge of the admissions process on the second floor. She was quickly brought into all of the important decision-making. We started having all staff meetings, meaning all staff. There were about 50 people up there. And everyone from the dean to the person who pushes the mail cart around and delivers mail and the telephone receptionist would come to these meetings. We simply closed the graduate school completely, and every single secretary, associate dean, everyone went to the all staff meetings. And we asked everyone to say something about what they do day to day. Just speak up to the whole group and tell everyone.
You ask everyone to get up and talk about what they
do? We had an open town meeting, and everyone was expected to come prepared to say something about what they do, what they are proud of doing, what they find irritating or challenging or difficult or unnecessary, whatever they wanted to say, anything. And as you might imagine, given what I said earlier about the culture in the graduate school, the people on the second floor really didn't want to say anything. There was a, this sounds a little overly dramatic, but they themselves would describe it as a culture of fear. They were afraid that if they spoke up and said something or were too candid or too honest, there would be negative consequences. They'd be fired as a troublemaker or something like that. And I remember telling them one time that I wanted everyone to talk about a serious mistake they had made, something they did that was really stupid. And I led off by saying something that I had done that was really dumb, and that in retrospect I wish I hadn't done it. A decision that was made in the graduate school that had bad consequences. I can't even remember what it was. But most people said they really couldn't think of anything. It just wasn't anything that. And so I remember telling them, if you aren't making some mistakes, if you aren't making some bad decisions, then you're not being bold enough in what you're doing. Because not everything that you try that's new and different is going to work out. And I expect you to try some things that are so unusual, so different, so adventuresome that they won't work. And if you're not doing that, if you next meeting, if you can't report something that you tried that didn't work, then I'm going to think you weren't trying hard enough.
Did it work?
Oh, yeah. They became very expressive in future meetings. Everyone went back and talked about it, and it got a lot of coffee room buzz for the next few weeks. What that crazy dean had just told them, that he wanted them to be making bad decisions.
Well, the risk taking is really important. And
it's just like evolution in nature. Nature makes mistakes, and some things become extinct because they made the wrong changes, and other things thrive.
Now, I hate to revert back to Dean Bach again, but was his culture one that would not have welcomed something like that? In terms of, first of all, just the general meeting and the airing of the...
I think he was not a very gregarious person. He didn't... I have the impression that he preferred to sort of work by himself with his trusted associates and not have big meetings of any kind. There were not staff meetings regularly in the graduate school, so I'm told. And I have mixed feelings about staff meetings myself. I think they serve, as much as anything, they serve a social function to make people constantly aware and reminded that they're part of an overall team. I don't think a whole lot of useful work gets done in staff meetings. Usually. Maybe that's just because I don't organize them well enough.
No.
But they didn't do it under Bach. And I think, whether this is fair or not, the attitude seemed to be the dean and the associate deans will make the decisions and you will do what you're told.
About that for a little bit. Let's go back. We're going to talk now about the Advanced Opportunity Fellowships program in the graduate school.
But before we get to that, let's return to the College of Engineering for one moment. And again, you hinted on, talked about this very briefly in your last set of interviews. But what kind of minority and recruitment, minority hiring, minority recruitment, minority enrollment programs, and minority fellowship programs were in operation at the College of Engineering during your years there? I realize that you were research dean, so you weren't, you know, plugged right into that, but, or were you?
Well, sure, at the graduate student level I was, not at the undergraduate level. In engineering, there was an engineering minorities program headed by Al Hampton, Alfred Hampton. And he was a very interesting guy, also more a leader than a manager. He was an old old-line Baptist preacher or something. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think he might literally have been a minister at an earlier time in his life. But he was very good on the stump. He could give a rousing talk spontaneously. He and I became friends, and he was very helpful in helping the material science program recruit minority students. Mm-hmm. Even so, they were pretty scarce. We didn't have very many. And most of the ones that we did have, we also got some help from Akbar Ali, mm-hmm. who at that time was an assistant dean in the graduate school and was in charge of managing the advanced opportunity fellowships. Mm-hmm. So I knew Akbar from my days in engineering, from dealing with him as the person I had to talk to get an AOF for a graduate student.
How effectively, when you moved into the graduate school, and you had a chance to review the program in operation there, how effectively had the program for advanced opportunity fellowships been handled in the graduate school prior to your arrival?
Well, without without intending to blame anyone, not very. Mm-hmm. Up until 1969 or so, I think it's probably fair to say that just about all of the minority students on campus who were graduate students were supported by advanced opportunity fellowships. Now, to put that in perspective, I'm not going to remember the numbers from 1969, but I'll give you today's numbers, and you'll immediately see what the problem is. We have something on the order of $60 to $70 million of student financial aid for graduate students, meaning teaching assistantships, research assistantships, fellowships of all kinds. About $2 million of that is AOF money, Advanced Opportunity Fellowships. $2 million a year. If all of the minority students must be supported on that $2 million and they don't have access to the other 60 or so million, then you've decided de facto how many minority students you're going to have on campus. It's the number that you can support with the AOF program. And that's a pretty pathetically small number. So, as soon as we realized that, and when I say we, you'll have to ask Paul the exact order.
Paul Barrows, the exact order of
when he came to the graduate school. But not too long after I came up there as dean, Paul joined, and he was instrumental. In fact, he was single-handedly responsible for. Mm-hmm. Revising the way we handled the AOF money.
Well, there was also a big, to explain why things perhaps had been handled the way they had been. Around this time, this became a very major issue, especially on this campus.
Yes.
How about the Chancellor? She was certainly in favor of this.
Chancellor Shalala instituted what was called the Madison Plan to bring more diversity to the campus.
That was the year before?
Yeah, that
about
was
about 88 or
was
so?
It was 88, 89, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that included faculty, staff, and student diversity, including graduate student diversity. So we were under a fresh mandate to do what we could to improve the diversity in the graduate school. Mm-hmm. And over the subsequent 5 or 6 years, I think we came close to doubling the number of minority students, the percentage of minority students in graduate school. But it was, what it required was a lot of personal effort on the part of Paul and his staff, mm-hmm. calling individual departments and programs and explaining over and over and over what a small amount of AOF money there was and how departments that wanted to get that money had to commit some of their own money as well in match. And you can just, you don't even need a pencil and paper, you can run the numbers in your head. If every AOF fellowship is matched by some other kind of comparable student support, you roughly double the number of students. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, that's about what we did.
There you go. Paul mentioned an incident that was very vivid in his mind. I'm wondering if you were aware of this. Apparently, the Chancellor Shalala found out, I think at the airport it was, that she heard from someone that the valedictorian of Spelman College was not accepted into the English Graduate School program here at Madison. And apparently, she made some phone calls right from the airport. She was extremely agitated by this comment, and that Paul said it was one of the things that sort of got things going. Do you recall that incident?
I don't, but if Paul's the one who got the phone call, I'm sure he would remember it. Anyone who ever got an agitated phone call from Donna remembers it.
I don't remember him saying that. He was the one that was the recipient of the call. But
I don't remember that incident specifically. I remember a different one, though, that's sufficiently similar that I'm wondering if there were really two of them.
Mm-hmm.
You'll have to ask Paul about this and see if he remembers these as two separate incidents. I remember that a National Science Foundation fellowship winner from Spelman College, that would be a black female, in chemical engineering, was accepted into the graduate program in chemical engineering. And after a relatively short time, I want to say half a year, certainly not more than a year here on this campus, quit in disgust because of poor treatment by her advisor. And that raised a lot of fuss, too.
Yeah.
And Paul and I spent a lot of time going out and telling departments that they had better be aware that the historically black colleges in the South, like Spelman, pay a lot of attention and track and follow their alumni very, very carefully. And mentor them and talk to them frequently on the phone and know what's going on. And incidents like this poison the source for a long time.
That's right.
It'll be a long time before chemical engineering gets another Spelman graduate as a result of that incident. And so we can't afford to have things like this happening. And we were telling departments, you really need to pay attention to how these students get matched up with advisors. Mm-hmm. The particular student advisor combination that resulted in this incident was one that anyone could have seen coming a mile away, mm-hmm. just because of the professor's style. He's terrific in some ways, but he's this was mixing oil and water, mm-hmm. putting those two together. Mm-hmm. And anyone who had looked at the situation would have seen that.
Paul gave me this chart. He said you would remember that more than likely. And there seemed to be, as far as I've been able to figure out, we're talking about minority students now. There seem to be three things that happen. You recruit the student, you get the money to give that student research funding, and then you work on retaining that student. Could you
Right.
talk about how that whole process changed under your administration?
Yeah, I do remember this chart. And
this chart, by the way, will be on file in
okay.
In your...
Well, it sort of summarizes the integrated view that we had of recruitment, retention, and graduation. We tried to pay attention to all aspects of the pipeline and subjected this area to the same kind of analysis of a gathering of factual data, analyzing them to see what they mean, and then acting accordingly, doing what we had to do to fix any problems that we saw. And this diagram was one of the many outcomes of that process, mm-hmm. Trying to visualize for ourselves how all the various pieces fit together and where the key leverage points were and so on.
How were you able to convince some of the other colleges and schools on campus to buy into the AOL program? Was that difficult?
Well, not only was it difficult, it never really happened in some cases. I mean, I did not mean to imply that we were always successful in convincing people. In fact, to this day, there are departments out there that behave, in my view, outrageously in taking the point of view that the AOF money is simply another pot of money to be tapped. And the way you will tap it is you'll give all of your fellowships that you have that are under departmental control and unrestricted to white students, and then you'll go to the graduate school to get funding for all of your minority students, period.
Oh my.
Yes.
What about, were there any colleges and schools that active that you were able to work with successfully?
Yeah.
Could you give an example of one or two of those?
Well, in the sciences, this is a little bit unfair because in the sciences it's a little easier to find alternative sources of money. Some of the humanities departments really have very little except TAs and a few fellowships. And so I do have some sympathy with the lack of alternative sources of support in some parts of the campus. But the Department of Sociology, I think, was very good about working with us to balance the funding packages for their students. Chemical engineering was very good.
Hmm.
Paul can give you some, I'll leave him to give you the bad actors, the ones that, that gave us fits. But this is in some ways just natural behavior of any organization in time of tight money. You try to tap every source of money. Mm-hmm. And if any, I don't know that there's any solution to this. If there's any source of money that has strings attached to it, that's set aside for only one particular use, then it's natural that will be the use it's put to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right, that's where people will go. Yeah. Now, was that money WARF money, essentially?
No, that's state money.
That's state money, okay.
Yes, that's a very important point. I think it's something that we should, that the historical record should show that the state of Wisconsin was maybe the first, certainly among the first. You ought to look into this, Barry.
I will.
In putting up state taxpayer money for graduate level fellowships for targeted minority and disadvantaged students. The Advanced Opportunity Fellowship Program is a state funded program.
Do other universities that you know of have programs similar to that, run by the state?
Well, there are some, yeah. But I think this one was the first and is the oldest and maybe one of the biggest.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
And now the AOP, the state calls it AOP, Advanced Opportunity Program. We refer to it as AOF for Advanced Opportunity Fellowship. But there is some AOP money in the law school and the med school as well. So there are some advanced opportunity fellowships for professional schools as well as the graduate school.
One of the things that Paul talked about that interested me was the whole concept of linkage with other schools like Spelman.
Yeah.
Was this something that increased as well?
Yeah. That's something that Paul and Marcel and Akbar have worked on for many years and very effectively. We have formal signed agreements with a number of schools and we send faculty there for visits. We bring their faculty here. We try to recruit students from there.
Now, that would be Marcel Lee, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, for those listening.
Yeah.
What about the whole area of faculty hires of minorities? How involved was the graduate school in that? How involved could you be, and how involved did you become?
The graduate school is involved only after the hiring decision has been made, for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And their involvement is largely one of helping departments and colleges put together what are called startup packages. Flexible one-time money that's used to help someone get started when they move here. Buy laboratory equipment, hire laboratory staff, summer salary for the first couple of summers, that sort of thing. These packages can be quite expensive. They range from a few tens of thousands of dollars at the bottom end to well over $1 million for lab scientists in areas that have very expensive equipment.
Wow. Getting back to the Advanced Opportunity Fellowships, when did that program begin? Do you know?
I don't remember. I don't know. Before my time.
Wow. And it's still going strong?
Oh, yeah. In fact, we asked for a budget increase from the legislature in this biennium and didn't get it, but we'll try again next time.
Okay.